Welcome again to another MiningStockEducation.com expert interview. I'm Bill Powers, your host. The topic of today's discussion is regarding using leverage in precious metals and mining stock investing. Leverage, as any savvy business owner or investor knows, can dramatically increase the growth rate of one's wealth when things go in your favor. I personally know an individual who turned $1,500 into $1.2 million in only a few years using a margin account and leverage through futures contracts. His astronomical gains would not have been possible without leverage. But when you use leverage to invest and things don't go in your favor, your wealth can begin to evaporate quite quickly. You can even lose more than your original capital invested. Here to discuss the use of leverage in precious metals and mining stock investing is returning guest Dave Kranzler of Investment Research Dynamics. Dave co-manages a precious metals and junior mining stock fund out of Denver and is the editor of the Mining Stock Journal and Short Sellers Journal. Dave, welcome back and thank you for joining me today.
Bill, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to do this show. Well, it's my second time, so the first time was a pleasure, that's for sure.
Dave, for the purpose of our discussion today, I would like you to share your thoughts regarding using leverage from both the perspective and approach as a fund manager and also that of a retail investor. As you know, many people are attracted to mining stocks because of the built-in leverage that they provide to the underlying commodity that the mining company mines. And what comes to play in such a volatile sector, as you already know, is fear and greed. And so my first question for you today is, when investing in mining stocks, the emotions of greed and fear are always at play. What advice would you offer to listeners regarding how the emotions of greed and fear can negatively affect the mining stock investor? And what can investors do to appropriately keep these emotions under wrap so that they can make good investing decisions?
Greed and fear. Well, I mean, I saw the greed aspect with some of my subscribers of the Mining Stock Journal, where I had recommended a stock, I think it was last April or May. It was called Almadex, and they're exploring and advancing a copper-gold porphyry deposit down in Mexico. It's a spinoff from Almaden Minerals, which, and I love the management of this company. I've met the CEO. I've chatted with, he's now the chairman. His son is now the CEO. They're very accomplished geologists, and they're great managers of mining, you know, their mining companies. So I had recommended this stock. I think it was around 26 or 28 cents. And it traded up over a dollar in the frenzy last summer because they're just releasing ridiculous drilling results on their property down in Mexico. And for me, I don't want to chase a stock that's going straight up. When they go parabolic, like the Bitcoin, I wouldn't, you know, even if I believed in Bitcoin, I wouldn't buy it here because parabolic charts are meant to be sold, not purchased. So part of the fear aspect comes in fear of missing out. And I had, in one of my issues, I even said, look, you know, wait until this thing pulls back and don't buy it. And some people bought it when it was over a buck. I mean, it ran up really quickly. And it sold off at when the sector corrected in the fall and into this, you know, this past winter. People were freaking out, and I was just like, you know, you chase it, just hold it. And so then all of a sudden, fear of missing out becomes fear of losing money. And if you just waited for it to pull back, I think it pulled back down to the low set. It might have even got into the high 60s at one point, and it's back up close to it's pressing a dollar again. They just released great drilling results. So the greed is the greed comes when a stock's going up, and it's fear of missing out on gains. And then the fear comes in when you know, you invest in something and you have, you're optimistic, you have all this hope of something going higher, and you know you're convinced you're right on the idea, and all of a sudden it might go down for a while, you know, and then you're like, oh no, did I make a mistake? You know, it's fear of making a mistake, fear of losing money, and it's extremely difficult to divorce yourself from those emotions and just try and look at the market objectively. I mean, I've probably gotten to a point where I've been able to divorce about 80% of my emotions from the market. And that's, I mean, I've been doing you know, investments and working on Wall Street and whatnot since 1985. And I would actually, even before I went to college, I was playing with penny stocks. So the problem that with using leverage is that, well, first I wanted to say that, you know, and the greed and the fear is amplified when you get into more volatile investments. So if you want to look at Dow stocks, you know, just sort of I'm talking in basic examples here. So the Dow stocks would be less volatile than, say, the large cap mining stocks, the stocks that are in the Huey Index or the XAU. And then the junior mining stocks would be a lot more volatile than the stocks, the large cap mining stocks. So as you step out in terms of volatility of investment, and then futures are kind of extreme volatility, as you step out the curve in terms of volatility, the degree of fear ratchets up when you start playing with you know, higher volatile situations. I mean, just look at Amazon stock. I mean, it's been as high as 1,083 and as low as 960 just in the last 3 weeks. So, you know, and then when you introduce leverage into that equation, it magnifies the volatility and it magnifies your emotions that are connected to it, because you can make money a lot faster and you can lose money a lot faster.
What do you think are some things that the average retail investor that's investing in these volatile sectors because they want the high gains, what are some things that they would need to add to their perspective or their ability to analyze the stock so that they could better control these emotions of greed and fear?
Well, first of all, I mean, you know, one of the topics you wanted to discuss was using leverage or using margin. And I'm really not a big proponent of using leverage, especially with regard to buying gold and silver and buying the mining stocks. I mean, yeah, you might get lucky and make a killing, you know, like the example you gave of your friend. You know, but you got to ask yourself, is that luck or skill? So you know, if you're applying leverage, you might get lucky. I mean, it's hard enough as it is, especially when you start going down into the junior mining stock realm, to find stocks that are ultimately going to be winners, meaning they're going to go from, you know, an evergreen piece of property that they're going to start drilling into a full-fledged mine. I mean, you're talking about a less than 1 in 10 probability. So, and when the market's hot, like it was in the summer of 2016, all these stocks go up. It's a rising tide floats all boats. So all the juniors were moving higher, whether it was deservedly so or not. So in terms of trying to control your emotions, you need to use prudence in what you're investing in and understand what exactly you're investing in. So with junior stocks, I mean, over the long term, if you had a portfolio of 10 junior stocks, the odds of one or two paying off are, you know, you might get one or two of those stocks that pay off, say over a 5 or 10 year period, and you're going to lose money on the other ones, or you'll lose money on half of them, and some of them you'll break even. And the two, you know, the one or two or three that work out, it's going to more than make up for what you've lost on the other stocks that didn't make it. And so I guess with regard, I assume you want to sort of keep the discussion confined to the precious metals and mining stock sector.
Primarily, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, like if you're playing in the junior mining stocks, you want to try and build a portfolio of at least 5 or 10 stocks. And don't chase when the price starts moving higher, don't chase it. And it's the hardest thing to do. It's the hardest thing to do to wait until prices come down, because especially in this sector and the way the markets are now, when prices start going down, everyone's in fear and no one wants to touch these stocks. And that's actually when you want to take a look at these stocks and figure out which ones you know, which are the horses you want to bet on, is after they've gone through, you know, a pretty significant sell-off period, and no one wants to invest in them. And the time that you don't want to invest in these things is after they've had a big run-up. Because even if the price of gold and silver are going to be in an extended uptrend, you're still, just because of natural volatility, you know, at a point it's just statistics and math. There's going to be natural volatility that's going to give you a sell-off at some point where you're going to have an opportunity to get back into these stocks. So, and if you use leverage, if you've got a portfolio and you're levered up and all of a sudden the market goes down and you can't figure out why it's going down and all of a sudden you start getting margin calls, the problem with leverage is, you know, especially with a volatile investment sector like the junior mining stocks, you might start having to sell some of these stocks because of margin calls, and you're going to end up not being involved in them or not owning them at the worst possible time because you're going to have to sell them at a time when you should be looking at whether or not you should buy them. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So, you know, for instance, with my mining stock journal, I'm going to start looking at some of the sort of small to mid-cap actual producing stocks that have had the crap beat out of them over the last, well, really since last fall. Because some of them, they're just phenomenal opportunities to jump into. You know, for instance, one of them is First Majestic, AG. And that ran from 2 up to, I think it might have hit 20 at one point. And then it sold back down. I mean, it's down below 7. I think it closed at 658 today. And I think it was, I don't know if it got under 6, but it was low 6s. And you know, I don't really typically invest in large cap producing stocks, but we put some in our fund because I'm like, you know what, if we're right about this sector and we're going to start moving higher again, you know, this is a day trader darling, it's a chat room darling, and it's a momentum darling, and this thing's going to move up very quickly.
And it's highly liquid. You can get in and out of it whenever you want.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's an example of the types of opportunities I'm going to start sprinkling into the mining stock journal until we get a real trampling of the bull market back underway, which I think is eventually going to happen in this sector.
Dave, First Majestic, I had a core position last year. I did really well on that. And then I did use my margin account to buy First Majestic maybe for a week or two, and that was when it was going up, and it was, you know, quite amazing the gains you could get on borrowed money. You mentioned in general, you know, you're cautious about margin or using margin as leverage, but do you think there's any role or how would you possibly think it would be prudent or wise to use margin? Like, I use it for swing trading. If I saw an uptrend, I would basically enter a position maybe for 5 days and then sell the position for $1,000, $2,000. What's your perspective on that, both as a fund manager and as a retail stock investor?
Yeah, absolutely. And so let's say you've got a portfolio of junior mining stocks, and I don't even think most of these juniors you can use margin on them. I think most of them, if not all of them, are unmarginable. But let's just say, you know, you're kind of at a point where you're fully invested and you feel confident about the market. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can, if you can use margin to put on a swing trade like First Majestic or, you know, even some of the smaller ones that are actual producing stocks and that are traded on the NYSE, and you can use margin on them. But be aware that, you know, like you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, the use of margin cuts both ways. And the one thing that's besides when to buy a stock, probably what's even harder is when to sell a stock. So you were smart. You took your profits in AG before the sector got toppled at the end of last, I think it was the end of July, early August, when the sector started getting hit hard. And I think that's when First Majestic might have started going down. But, you know, you did not have margin on for a very long period of time. And when you had booked a gain in it, or when you had a nice gain in it, you took it. And I assume you basically went off margin at that point.
Yeah, I was not on margin when things were going downhill in the latter half of the year. I still had a core position, but I zeroed out my margin spending, you know, by September for sure last year.
Yeah, AG started going down on August 8th. So, you know, again, it's really hard to decide when to sell one of these stocks, especially if you got a gain in it, and it's, that's when the greed factor kicks in, and that's when you just got to say, okay, you know, I bought AG on margin, I've got a 25, 50% rate of return, I'm not going to get greedy here, the thing is, you can't sit there the next day and kick yourself if it goes up again after you sell something. You just got to either just don't look at it or just say, hey, I got my goal in it. I mean, I've read this advice for 30 years. Occasionally you'll run across a guy who's a successful trader or hedge fund manager, and he'll say, look, I don't care. I'm not trying to time the bottom and the top. If I get the middle 60% of a move, I'm going to make money every single time, especially if I avoid accidents by getting greedy and trying to high tick something.
You know, the gentleman I mentioned at the beginning of the show who turned $1,500 into $1.2 million, I've sat next to him in front of his screen, and that's exactly what he does. He finds a trend, and he trades the trend, and he's in and out a lot of times in the same day, or never holds a position more than a few days, and uses margin and leverage. And he was showing me one particular company, and I said, what does that company do? And he says, I don't know, is what he told me. And I said, you're putting your money in that company, but you don't even know. He says, I don't care. I'm looking at the candlesticks, and I'm looking at the momentum, and this is where I believe it's going over the next 2 days, and therefore I'm going to put my money in here. And that is not my approach. I like more of the fundamental and maybe a little technical analysis before I put my money into a company.
That's right. And honestly, over the long term, I mean, yeah, there's, if you take 100,000 people who are traders, and that's what they do, you know, over a long period of time, you're going to have a certain percentage of those are going to be lucky, and they're going to do well. You know, and you have to say, is it luck or is it skill? And I know my finance professors at University of Chicago would say it's really more luck than skill. But most of those, that population sample of 100,000 traders, most of them are going to lose money, and they won't be around very long. So, and your friend is probably one of these guys who's into this. He clearly has some skill in reading charts, but, you know, as long as he's not doing it on margin, because if he gets overconfident and has a big position on when all of a sudden you wake up one morning and the Dow and S&P futures are lock limit down, that's not going to be a good day for him.
As Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story is he built his account up to $1.2 million. He paid off his mortgage, which was a good use, and then he lost most of it trading.
Oh, well, there you go.
But at least he paid off his mortgage. If you can pay off your mortgage for $1,500.
He was smart enough to at least eliminate that portion of leverage from his life.
Yep.
Knowing that what he was doing is high risk.
Dave, as you know, another form of leverage is options, both put and call options. We've talked about First Majestic. Another form of leverage that I've used is you can buy 2-year out of the money call options on First Majestic. And, you know, if you believe the silver price is going up, that's a potential way to use leverage. And a lower risk way of using leverage. What's your perspective on buying 2-year out call options on a company like First Majestic? And what are some good ways that you use put and call options?
Well, it depends on what kind of premium you're paying. With that particular call option, what's the strike and what's the maturity?
I don't remember. That was last year I did that, so I don't have my brokerage account pulled up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. To tell you the truth, options are a good way for Wall Street to pick the pocket of individual investors. And actually, with my short seller's journal, I know a lot of subscribers like to play around with options, and I've gotten a lot of success stories out of there. And what I do is I always say, look, your best bet of having success in this trade is just short the stock outright. But if you want to use puts, this is what I'm thinking, and this is what and I actually having, you know, I tell people not to use puts and calls, and yet when I'm shorting the market, because I'm largely invested in mining stocks, I mess around with put options. So but in terms of just general use of options, my preference is to take the market maker side and sell volatility to the speculator, which means I'm going short calls or I'm going short puts. So when I had said that we put AG into the fund, what we did is we shorted the October 7 strike puts. And we shorted them, I want to say we shorted them close to a buck. And they're now 45, 50 cents. So I'm sorry. I was looking at the calls. Yeah, we shorted them. I think it was a buck 20 per put. And now that's like 90 by 95 cents. So we've got about a 30 cent profit per put option in it because we shorted the put option. And the reason why I liked that, it was around $1.20 now that I think about it, because when I talked to my partner about it, I said, look, we can short these for $1.20. These are the puts at a 7 strike. So that means our effective cost, if we end up getting put to, which means if the stock closes below 7 by October 20th, we're going to get put the shares. And that's fine because our implied cost per share is $5.80, the strike price minus the cost of the put. On the other hand, and I'll own AG at $5.80 all day long. Absolutely. On the other hand, if AG goes above 7 or closes above 7 on the expiration date, and we sold a lot of puts, we're going to be able to keep the premium that we collected from shorting those puts at $1.20. So either way, you know, and that would be like, you know, I forget where the stock was when we did the trade. It was around $6.20, I think, $6.20. And so essentially that would be the same as buying the stock at $6.20 and selling it at $8.20, right? It'd be the strike price plus we got paid $1.20 per put option. So the implied sale price on the stock would be $8.20. Now, if AG even goes higher, would we have been better off just owning the stock? Certainly. But it was just one of those trades where I'm like, look, I'd love to own it below $6, and if we don't get put to, we're going to collect a big fat payday on by keeping the premium on the puts we sold. So that's an example of what I mean when I say sell volatility.
And you would only do that with a stock you'd want to own.
I would only do it with puts with a stock that I want to own. That's correct. And you can do the same thing if you're shorting something. You can short out of the money calls, and you would only want to do that with a stock that you might end up being short that stock. And that's so if you get into a nice, like with AG with the calls that are 2 years out, I'm just looking at them right now, the January 2019s, you can buy the January 2019 8 strikes for $1.65. So you're saying, okay, by January 2019, I think AG will be higher than $9.65, the $8 strike price plus the $1.65 premium. I think that's probably a pretty good bet. And that would be a good, again, I guess, to your point, if you're going to speculate on these companies like AG with calls, I would go a year and a half to 2 years out and just buy something that's somewhat close to where it's trading now. So this is AG closed at $6.52. So it's $1.50 out of the money. Buy something, that's sort of a near money strike price, and just hold it like you'd hold a stock for a long term investment, and don't worry about it on a day to day basis.
Another leveraged product, an ETF that you, I remember you wrote about in the Mining Stock Journal last year, was JNUG, which is the daily triple leveraged bullish junior miner ETF, and the corresponding DUST, the bearish triple leveraged. Could you share your thoughts about JNUG? And I know you have written about how you invest or utilize JNUG with options, if you could share some of your approach to that product.
Sure. You know, again, with JNUG and with Dust, they're triple leverage products. So you gotta going into it, you gotta realize your fear and greed emotions are gonna be 3 times what they might be if you just buy, First Majestic outright. The problem again with these ETFs is that the triple levered ones, and it doesn't matter which triple lever ETF it is, they kind of intrinsically lose about 10% a month from premium decay. So these triple levered ETFs are they're basically structured using options and over-the-counter derivative products that have time premium and volatility of premiums priced into the instruments that they use to make these trusts. So, and that's where it's just like a put or a call option that you go long. There's time premium decay as it gets closer to expiration. Well, it's the same dynamic in these triple levered ETFs, and that time premium decay on average and in general is about 10% a month. So when you go long something like JNUG, you got to realize you're up against that type of decay on a monthly basis. So if the mining stock sector just sits there and goes laterally, sideways for a month, you're going to lose 10% of your investment in JNUG. The JNUG, I think, is, and I'll just talk about it from the JNUG perspective. It applies to both ways. I think if you feel really confident that we're going to go into a period where we're going to get a big move in the mining stocks, then I think JNUG's okay. Similarly, like buying on margin, make it a short-term trade and don't get greedy. A lot of times, what we like to do in the fund is we might go long JNUG, and I wouldn't chase JNUG after a big run. I mean, I would, like right now, it's at 1797. It's definitely at the lower end of its 2 year trading range. If you look at a graph at it, I mean, it actually looks like a really nice chart, and it's probably a chart that you'd want to go long right now. But so what we'll do is we might get long JNUG if we've got some spare cash sitting around. We have cash come in, and we don't have a new idea yet. We'll buy JNUG, and we'll also sell some out-of-the-money calls against that. So what it means is we restrict the upside if JNUG goes crazy to the upside, but we've also somewhat reduced our risk because when you sell the calls against a long position, it's a covered call position, and it reduces the overall basis in the cost of the position. So it somewhat reduces the risk of using JNUG. The other thing we might do is say, okay, well, the sector might not be quite done going down, which you could probably say right now, and we might sell some out-of-the-money puts on JNUG. So same concept that we did with First Majestic, only we do it with JNUG, where we'll sell puts, collect the premium, and if we get put to, we're happy to get put to JNUG because we'd want to buy it outright at that level anyway. It reduces our investment basis in owning the stock. So, again, I guess to summarize, I think using JNUG is a good short-term speculative tool, but I wouldn't use it in lieu of, buying a high-quality miner at these levels. Like, make sure you have a good portfolio of high-quality miners that have been beaten up over the last 12 months, or if you're playing in the juniors, make sure you've got your investments there and look at it, that you're looking at as long-term investments, and then maybe supplement it, just trying to speculate on the market direction with JNUG.
Yeah, and a lot of times I think you can speculate with JNUG surrounding geopolitical events that will send gold up, like we had Brexit last year.
Absolutely.
And so if you bought JNUG the day before, I think in 2 days you made about 40% or something like that after Brexit last year, last June. One more leverage product that when it comes to precious metals investing is, of course, the futures contract. Gold and silver's futures contracts. What's your thoughts regarding using futures contracts?
Man, the futures are that's the devil's playground. Just because of the embedded leverage in there. I actually went through a period from about 2004 to 2007 where I traded silver futures, and I did it. I mean, it was an everyday thing. I would stay up until about 2 in the morning, or until I couldn't stay awake anymore, and trade the futures in what was then called the access market, after India and China had opened up. And that was a pretty good bull run period for silver, 2004 to 2007. And then I would go to sleep for like three or 4 hours and wake up before the COMEX opened and start trading again. And that's how my day was for fairly long period of time. And I made a lot of money trading silver futures that way. And then after the 2008 period, when the precious metals got hit, obviously the stock market got hit. I tried to keep at it after that, and it was just too hard. The intervention in the precious metals market became even more intense than it was sort of before that 2008 period. And I just stopped trading it because it was impossible to make money. And I know a lot of silver traders who stopped trading the market between 2008 and 2010. Because the intervention just made it impossible to do any kind of trend trading, the types of trading techniques that your friend uses, where he just looks at the chart and says, "Okay, this is a 2-day trade, I'm in and out, and I don't care what happens." The intervention made it impossible to do that. And so, I guess in general, I wouldn't recommend futures for, kind of the non-professional investor. Because I think, again, it's one of those things where you might get lucky once or twice, but over time you're going to lose money trading futures. And it's just one of those things, if you're going to do it, it's one of those things that you got to be there, and you need to be on top of it at all times, and you got to exercise utmost discipline. I mean, that was one of, I gave back a lot of money in silver futures because I got fat and happy and I stopped exercising discipline.
Dave, before you go, do you have any concluding thoughts that you'd like to share with listeners regarding using leverage?
Sure. I don't want to give the audience the impression that I'm saying don't use leverage. It's too dangerous. In the right doses, it can be a good thing. I would, It's better though to just, if you're not sure about the market, there's no reason to have leverage. And if you're losing sleep at night, there's no reason to have leverage. I mean, the junior mining stocks alone have embedded leverage in them. And we don't leverage up the fund that I manage for that purpose, because we're mostly junior mining stocks, well, aside from the physical bullion. And that's what we look at as our leverage. So whenever there's been really bad periods for the sector, we've been able to stay in business. We haven't been forced to sell anything because we're not on leverage. We're not even in margin on that in that account. The other thing I'd just like to say in summary is that, especially for people who came to the precious metals sector, say around 2010 or maybe even later, it's frustrating to deal with the way the intervention operates on the market. But it's easy to lose sight of the fact that if you look at the entire bull market for precious metals, starting in however you want to measure it, late 2000 or early 2001, gold has been the best made performing major asset class, bar none, in that time period from, say, 2001 until now, including the stock market. So it's one of these things that, you know, look at the intervention this way. If the government and the central banks are trying to discourage you from buying it by intervening in the market, that means it's probably something that you should be invested in. So, Bill, I'll leave you and the audience with that.
Thanks, Dave. And if listeners are interested in learning more about Fouling Dave, you can find him on the web at investmentresearchdynamics.com. And there you can also learn about his short sellers journal and also his mining stock journal. Thanks very much for joining me, Dave.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.